Leaps in for Bill Bennett this morning on Bill Bennett's Morning in America. It is our pleasure, my honor, to introduce Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, one of the nation's leading, if not the world's leading, authorities on things Iran and Middle East. Michael, we appreciate you joining us this morning. Whenever we have you on, we get just a flood of emails after your interview asking where people can get more information. Just say up front, if you go to BillBennett.com and click on Michael Rubin's name, you can access all of his writings and all of his work and see what he's up to. Good morning, Michael.
Morning, Seth.
Thanks for being with us. Give us a broad overview yesterday of what happened with the United Nations and Iran yesterday, if you don't mind.
Well, a couple interesting things. The big story, of course, is the sanctions. The United Nations Security Council Resolution 1929, not meant to be a depressing number, but no matter what, imposed the fourth round of sanctions, which basically added and expanded upon the previous three rounds. Now, one of the big stories is that Turkey and Brazil voted against this resolution, and it's the first time we've had a resolution of sanctions upon Iran for its nuclear program that hasn't been unanimous at the Security Council. Lebanon, for its sake, abstained. What just as an aside, what's quite interesting to me, to be a little bit political, is that President Bush was often criticized for his Manichaean style of diplomacy, and people said he just couldn't rally the world behind him. But he was able to achieve three unanimous United Nations Security Council resolutions against Iran. President Obama spent more than a year trying to put this together, basically bargained away almost every chit we had, and still wasn't able to get a particularly strong set of resolutions.
Watered down the resolutions.
Exactly. It was diluted.
Could not get someone from our own backyard or the Middle East, or excuse me, the Muslim country he trumpets as the model, and that he spent so much time with Turkey.
Indeed, and a NATO member for that matter,
right,
as well. But the point being, and I don't think this is what we're focusing on right now, while the administration is backslapping itself for having gotten these sanctions passed, the fact of the matter is this isn't going to be the last round of sanctions, but what more does President Obama have to bargain? He's like the guy who walks into a used car showroom and says, I need a car, and I only have, the most I can spend is $20,000. And so the used car salesman says, that's fine, I have something here for $20,000. The problem is when he needs another car, he ain't going to have any money.
I don't even know if this is a car that drives in this case, though, Michael. I have to say we have had, as you pointed out, three earlier rounds of sanctions. And even as the New York Times writes up this morning on the front page, during those resolution regimes of sanctions, Iran has built secret centrifuge plants and enriched uranium at higher levels. Do we believe in sanctions as a solution to this problem?
Well, the administration's I think sanctions could be part of a solution. This administration's problem, and frankly, it's a criticism I also have of the Bush administration before it,
right,
is that it looks at sanctions and economic coercion as part of a sequential strategy. But the problem is, during the height of diplomacy, for example, under Ronald Reagan going with Gorbachev, or under Richard Nixon with Beijing, we didn't have a situation where someone tried sanctions, and if they didn't work, then maybe we'll start to think about the military option. When Reagan went and negotiated with Gorbachev, at no point did he have NATO or the United States let its guard down. In fact, quite the contrary, it was Reagan's preparation for a military solution which enabled the diplomacy to work, and that's something, unfortunately, President Obama doesn't understand.
We got the phrase out of that, now well remembered, trust but verify.
Exactly.
I don't think we're at trust yet, but we're nowhere near verify either if I read these sanctions right. Again, according to the Times, the sanctions require countries to inspect ships or planes headed to or from Iran, but there is no authorization to board ships by force.
Indeed, but there's actually two points I want to make that will actually shock people when they understand how the International Atomic Energy Agency works, which, of course, oftentimes inspects the nuclear plants. Number one, the International Atomic Energy Agency is only allowed to inspect declared nuclear sites, which means if U.S. intelligence feels that Iran has a secret nuclear facility, the IAEA has no right even to ask to inspect it. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, Sometimes we hear about how the International Atomic Energy Agency has put in video cameras to monitor Iran's centrifuge plants, its declared centrifuge plant at Natanz. What people don't understand, however, they assume that you have IAEA inspectors manning that video camera at all times and watching the tape remotely as it rolls. The fact of the matter is the IAEA inspectors only inspect that tape about once a month. And Iran could, in theory, divert enough highly enriched uranium. It could enrich its uranium stock to highly enriched uranium, bomb-grade material, in 17 days, meaning between the time when the IAEA inspectors bothered to watch the videotape.
Wow. That I did not know. Thank you, Michael. We're talking to Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute. I noticed another part of these sanctions that I thought were curious at best, making them feckless at probably worse. The advanced air defense missile system that Russia is pledging to deliver to Iran, not covered by the sanctions. That will go forward, can go forward.
That can go forward. Russia has said that they have suspended the sale of this S-300 missile system. And this has been a bone of contention with the Russians and the Iranians for quite some time. But when you look at Moscow's rhetoric, what the Kremlin is really trying to do is get the Iranians and the Americans in a bidding war to see who will give the Kremlin more to do or not do what the Kremlin shouldn't be doing in the first place. This again, on a broader way, is my problem with the way Obama's diplomacy has gone. Obama sacrificed, in many ways, Poland, Georgia, right, the Czech Republic, for the sake of getting these watered-down sanctions. If we need another round, what's he going to be willing to give up?
That's a very good point. I want to focus on the diplomacy now for a moment, if I can, with you, Michael. And we're talking to Michael Rubin, American Enterprise Institute, because we're coming up, I guess, this weekend on the year anniversary of the elections in Iran, the fraudulent elections in Iran, to be more accurate. Is that right? It's this Saturday,
isn't it?
This weekend, yeah. Now, President Obama has made diplomatic efforts. I don't think anyone could say he hasn't made diplomatic outreach to Iran, but it's been to the wrong people, has it not? My view is he has changed the course of American presidential diplomacy in speaking about immiserated people, people under the boot of a regime, by addressing, in the most complimentary terms, the leadership of Iran, not the people of Iran.
Indeed, that's actually been the big rhetorical difference between President Obama and every previous U.S. president since the Islamic Revolution, whether Democrat or Republican. President Obama has addressed his rhetoric to the Islamic Republic of Iran and its people, rather than just to the Iranian people. And in the very precise world of diplomacy, what this has done was clearly signal that President Obama was legitimizing the Islamic Republic at a time when a huge number of its people were trying to throw off the yoke of this theocracy.
Now, we have precedents. I mean, people sometimes will ask, well, what does it matter who the president addresses? The leadership is the people who are in power. That's who we have to deal with. What difference does it make if he talks to the people on the streets of Iran? Can I just review a little history? I know you know this history, but I love looking it up because it is so enlightening when I do. I mean, the difference between President Carter and President Ronald Reagan in the Cold War, one kissed the cheek of Brezhnev, one in his first full term didn't even have a meeting with the head of the Soviet Union. But what did President Reagan do during those first 4 years? He spoke clearly to the Russian people. I looked up, Michael, if you'll just bear with me, because I want to get your comments on this, but I think our audience will appreciate this. We're talking to Michael Rubin. I looked up what Anatoly Sharansky, who was then in prison in the Soviet Union, thought of at the time when Ronald Reagan did address the Soviet people and call the Soviet Union for what it was. He was asked, was there any particular Reagan moment you recall being a source of strength or encouragement to you and the dissidents? Here's what Sharansky said. I have to laugh. People who take freedom for granted take Ronald Reagan for granted. Of course. It was the great, brilliant moment when we learned that Ronald Reagan had proclaimed the Soviet Union an evil empire before the entire world. There was a long list of Western leaders who lined up to condemn what Reagan said. Front page stories about this dangerous, terrible man who wanted to take the world back to the dark days of the Cold War. But this was our moment. It was the brightest, most glorious day. Finally, a spade had been called a spade. Finally, Orwell's newspeak was dead. President Reagan had, from that moment, made it impossible for anyone in the West to continue to close their eyes to the real nature of the Soviet Union. Close quote. It matters what the president says and who he speaks to, doesn't it?
Oh, it most certainly does. And actually, the big shock which many policymakers, I remember having this discussion with the late, great Peter Rodman, had when the Cold War fell, was to understand just how much the rhetoric resonated with dissidents and shook authoritarian governments to their core. Our intelligence community, our senior presidential aides, didn't understand this at the time and were shocked, but this is a lesson from history which we should learn. I have to say that if the Soviet Union still existed today and President Obama wanted to go over and meet its leader, he wouldn't have just kissed them on the cheek. He probably would have bowed to them.
Yeah, I know. It's unfortunate. That's a very good point. I want to give you just a little more, Sharansky. Can you stay one more segment?
Of course, yeah.
I want to give people a sense of this, and a sense of this man, and a sense of how we handled it. Sharansky goes on in his answer about Ronald Reagan and the evil of the evil empire statement. He says, quote, "It was one of the most important freedom-affirming declarations, and we all instantly knew it. For us, that was the moment that really marked the end for them and the beginning for us. We were all in and out of punishment cells, me more than most, so we had to develop our own tapping language to communicate with each other between us. We had a secret code. We developed new communication methods to pass on the great impossible news. We tapped on the toilets." Wow. Michael, when we come back, I want to take some calls with you and speak a little bit further about the nature of the Iranian regime and the nature of our response to its ever-increasing menace, okay? Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to me and Michael Rubin, the American Enterprise Institute, talking about the UN sanctions regime that was imposed on Iran yesterday, U.S. policy towards Iran, and the dangers from Iran. Michael, I want to go to callers and take some of their questions, if that's all right with you.
That's great.
Great. We have Bob in Cleveland, Ohio, who had a question. Go ahead, Bob. Good morning.
Yeah, what I can't understand is India got the bomb, Pakistan got the bomb, North Korea got the bomb, and these countries, especially North Korea and Pakistan, have far less resources than Iran with their oil wealth. So for decades now, we've been hearing about Iran getting the bomb, Iran getting the bomb. It seems if they really wanted to get the bomb, that they have the resources to produce a bomb.
Why do they not have the bomb already, in other words? Michael?
Well, on part of your first question, the fact of the matter is India and Pakistan aren't members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So what Iran has been doing is trying to use Western technology, provided it under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to build the bomb. North Korea, why were they able to get the bomb? They were able to get the bomb because two reasons. They were willing to starve their own people, and the international community was willing to reward their defiance, to ship them $1 billion and more in terms of heavy fuel oil so that they didn't have to spend those resources on actually providing their own energy for their own people, and they dedicated themselves nonstop to the bomb. Now, with regard to Iran, it's used its oil wealth in two ways. One of the reasons why Iran, it's been willing to buy, for example, nuclear warhead design from Abdul Qadir Khan, the Pakistani nuclear scientist. At the same time, why haven't they done this sooner? Part of the reason is because they were still recovering from the Iran-Iraq war, which really took all their resources for a decade.
Now, there's another side to this coin, too, Michael. I hope it's not too obvious to point out. And, you know, for anyone at the administration level that is listening, I think it's worth pointing out again and again and again, which is when you take the examples we now face that Bob had cited, Pakistan, North Korea, once these countries go nuclear, what the United States or the West can do to stop them from further aggression, either on their own streets or outside of their borders, becomes very, very diminishing in the return. There is a very heavy limit to what we can do. When it looks like we are wandering around without a great North Korea policy or solution, there's a reason for that. It's because it's a nuclear country.
Well, indeed, and one of the things that concerns me, you were talking about Cold War history before,
yeah,
is we have this rosy-eyed memory of what mutually assured destruction was like, and people in the White House now, the young generation, just assume that deterrence always works. But the fact of the matter is, look, I mean, my father was almost mobilized for Cuba back in 1961 when he was doing his military service. We came pretty darn close there. Likewise, we came close. I still remember when I was in sixth grade when Korean Air 007 was shot down, and we came pretty close there. Now, that's just between us and the Soviet Union, and
right.
we had a channel communication.
Right.
What happens when you have 13 or 14 countries in the Middle East or in East Asia, Northeast Asia, that have this bomb? Frankly, we'd be crazy to trust in deterrence.
And mutually assured deterrence with regimes that don't believe that suicide is a problem, that death is a problem. It was Bernard Lewis who said that mutually assured destruction in the Middle East is not a deterrent. In fact, it could be an inducement.
Indeed, but even if we take the idea that the Iranian regime isn't suicidal, the nightmare scenario is here, is what happens if they have an uprising like they had last year and the regime knows that it's in its last day or two, that, to make another analogy, it's sort of like Ceausescu in Romania.
Right.
What happens then when the Revolutionary Guard has a nuclear bomb and figures, look, why don't we just launch it at Israel or someone else? After all, is anyone really going to retaliate against Iran after it's already had regime change tomorrow?
And after it listens to the president's disposition towards the whole Middle East.
Indeed. Yes, that's the problem.
Michael, we're running down, but you're holding a conference today. Is that right?
We're holding a conference at American Enterprise Institute looking back on 10 years of Bashar al-Assad's rule in Syria. Remember, he's a Western-educated eye doctor,
right.
So everything's going to be roses under him.
Right, right, right. Fabulous. Can people get watch that if they go to the AEI website? Or
It should be on shortly after the conference is over. The video will be posted at the AEI website.
Great. Fabulous. Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute, I thank you for joining us, and I look forward to your next appearance with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for all you do. Thanks for bringing your enlightenment, and thanks for the training and the education you give to our troops, too, who I know appreciate you so much, just as we do. This is Seth Leibson in for Bill Bennett on Bill Bennett's Morning in America.